Let's take on something new. Here we go again. Sometimes I cannot get these slides to advance. There we go. Okay. Anybody heard of Zen Franklin? He came up here just last time we met, I think. You know, he popped up in our studies, too. Here's a proverb, an uninspired proverb. It's not a biblical proverb, but it's a proverb. Diligence is the mother of good luck, according to Ben Franklin. Well, Ben, of course, was famous for the number of inventions and for his writings. You know, if you haven't read his autobiography, you ought to. It's really worth the time. Not very long either, but really very interesting. But he certainly was one who practiced what he preached when it comes to this topic. And so people talk about good luck all the time, good things come, as if it was just a happenstance. But diligence produces something. And diligence is the topic that we're going to be now delving into this evening. Again, as we get deeper into the book, it becomes more difficult to know exactly, where to put your collection of scriptures. So as you're building your little concordance there, I'd really recommend you could put these at chapter 10, verses 3 through 5, which we'll look at in a minute. But first, you might want to put it back at chapter 6, verses 6 through 11. And we've already covered those verses, and they dealt with diligence, but they dealt with it from the standpoint of the problems that come to the slugger, and is in fact addressed to the slugger. So you may find that your margin is too crowded at chapter 6, verses 6 through 11, with a list of scriptures about the sluggard to have enough room to put down now a list that's not quite as long, about the same size, I guess, on the topic, rather, of diligence. So if you don't have any room there, then put it over at chapter 10, verses 3 through 5. But while you're there, let's just read once again verses 6 through 11 in chapter 6. Go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provisions in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. So, it's addressed to the sluggard. Later on, it asks the rhetorical question of that sluggard, how long are you going to be sleeping right there? But it's actually giving us an illustration about diligence, isn't it? About that ant, which is absolutely tireless. They just don't take breaks. They don't know what that is. It's constantly and ever busy. And so, it is a diligence passage, as well, though mostly it's trying to focus on the harm, the disaster, that befalls the individual that is not diligent. However, when we come over to chapter 10, verses 3 through 5, and as you turn there, here's the rest of the list. So at either location, wherever you're going to put it, here are verses on diligence. And as I mentioned a moment ago, as we get deeper in the book, it becomes increasingly more difficult to put these lists together. Because just like chapter 6, verses 6 through 11, is on diligence as well as being on the sluggard, we're starting now to have more and more overlap. So it's not like Solomon sat down and said, well, I'm going to write some verses here, on this given topic, parenting, and they're not going to address or in any way impact any other topic you can think of. It's just mainly, locked down on that idea. Well, it's not. As you're reading the verses on parenting, you see a number of related subjects that are immediately adjacent and tied up in that. And we're going to be seeing more and more of that. So if as we're going along, you start thinking, well, this one should have gone into that category or that one would have gone over there, great. Get the lists down. And then in your future study, you'll start fleshing out the outline that I'm giving you here, and you'll start making your own connections. And then later, as you're working through the book of Proverbs or hunting to find some particular proverb, it'll work for you. So I'm giving you an outline, a beginning place, a foundation, and then, of course, you're going to build upon it. So in chapter 10, verses 3 through 5, that's where I put my list in this case again. Verse 3 says, the Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but he will thrust aside the craving of the wicked. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. That's the particular verse we're interested in now. And in verse 5, though, he who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who acts shamefully. Well, we've already talked about verse 5, and it had to do with the parenting thing. And so, you know, there's some overlap right there. The 3, 4, and 5, you could separate them. You could use them as individual thoughts. In this case, I've suggested, though, that they're so closely related, it might be a good idea for you to draw that circle around the verse numbers or tie them together in some other way, because they really flow very naturally one to the other. The Lord, brethren, cares about you. He is consciously aware of you. Whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament, both of them have verses about God's promise that He will care for you in the physical world. You are of more value than flowers and sparrows. He will count every hair on your head in the New Testament. But here in verse 3 of chapter 10, He will not allow the righteous to hunger, but He will thrust aside the craving of the wicked. When you fall on hard times, and virtually everybody does at some time in their life, the Lord is very conscious of what you're going through. He is there to protect you. He is there to provide for you. But what is the contingency in the verse? If what He'll prepare for you? Okay, now you're right, but look at the verse. What is it then contingent on in the verse? Righteousness. The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but He will thrust aside the craving of the wicked. Verse 3 is a contrast between the wicked and the righteous, and it demonstrates then that God is paying attention. He sees that the wicked also have problems in life, and they can fall on hard times. They can see that, you know, their dollars become few and their gold, you know, pretty thin. But their craving is of little consequence to the Lord. He thrusts it aside. So now suddenly, you know, they're crying out, "Oh God, save me, oh God, help me." He thrusts it aside. Where have we seen God thrust aside an appeal for help before in this book? At length. Jerry? And I also will mock at your calamity, that verse goes on to say. And so we've seen that in the last half of that first chapter in one of the larger sections in the whole book, where wisdom, in this case, is speaking up and says, when your disaster comes, your calamity, when your dread befalls you, then you will call for me, and I will not answer. I will mock, I will laugh at your calamity. So first point, you know, in verses 3 through 5 is, God is aware, God responds to the righteous. Your freedom from hunger, though, is contingent upon being righteous. Then in verse 4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. Now over here, surely he's got it right for it. And so there you've got to play your part. Now your hand comes in to use. You're going to have to get out there and work that shovel. You're going to have to get out there and do, you know, the task at hand. But still in verse 4, poor is he who works with a negligent hand. The hand of the diligent makes rich. Diligence, brethren, is an aspect or quality of righteousness. That's part of the description of the personality of the individual that God is trying to produce. In the Old Testament, again, or in the New. We have numerous passages about how we are to be very urgent and vigorous and constant, very animated. We are to be a people who are full of energy and about the business of righteousness and serving our God. And the one that works with a negligent hand is going to be poor. He who is diligent will be made rich. And this works both spiritually and physically. In this case, the emphasis is on the physical side. Solomon is saying the way the world works is this.
Those people who are always whining and complaining about having never had the opportunity. Life, you know, is against me. Murphy's Law, you hear me talking about so very much. Okay? They're laying it all off on him, but what is Solomon saying is, you know, more likely and usually the case. He just weren't as energetic about it as he should have been. You should have been ant-like, but you weren't. Poor is the one who works with a negligent hand. Now, brother to him who destroys, who is that? He who is slack in his work, negligent in his work, just lazy about it, is brother to him who destroys. Rachel, think you had a hand up? There's a lion in the street. Remember that one? Okay. Sure. God is all-wise and all-knowing. He is omniscient. He knows all things. So, he is not going to, you know, accept any of these excuses. Our part is to be absolutely diligent in every opportunity that we got. His part to bless that with his success. Sure.
Maid actually took in ironing most of the time, and she lived in one of these small backwater towns, and she probably went outside to pump. She may have still had an outside toilet too, as far as I know. I forget that. But people kept, you know, giving her more money and doing stuff and whatever. And when she died, she had $1 million to a black college for scholarships, because that's what was important to her, and she was just diligent, and she liked her life the way she was, and she didn't need all of those extra things everybody else said that she needed.
You hear these stories all the time, where somebody that everybody assumed, you know, is just impoverished, was actually quite wealthy, because in this case, you know, they're just diligent about their savings, you know, they're putting stuff away. So, you know, we have, you know, just there'd be innumerable illustrations of the principle. And then just to finish it out in verse 5, he who gathers in summer is the son who acts wisely. He who sleeps in harvest is the son who acts shamefully, which we saw in the parenting thing. It's our responsibility as parents, in a little while that we have in the course of our lives, to be training our children, try to teach them this principle. Of course, you know, kids by nature just want to do chores, don't they? Now I got you. When kids are little, do they want to do chores? They're beating your door down. In the beginning, they can't get enough in the beginning. And if parents learn how to capitalize on that and work with that, train that, and keep it going, you know, then we all laugh out loud. I do too. You know, I know eventually the time comes, you know, they're not so eager anymore. Well, maybe they would be if we all of us, you know, were as diligent in setting the example, you know, and just working with the kids there. So you do. You kind of start off with a natural inclination. I think every parent has seen it in their kids. We get tired of them. Go away. Stop pestering me. You know, kind of a thing. And yet, here they are starting off with this great attitude that will tend to make them rich and that will bring you glory and satisfaction rather than the shame that you see in verse 5. Now, I think I may have missed a hand or two as I was going through that last bit. Was there another one? Harry, was it you? Okay.
Well, I was going to say that George Washington Carver, the guy that found so many things to do with peanuts, you know, he was a rich man, and people went right to him and always borrowed money. And for half of the stuff he invented, he never took a payoff. I mean, they paid him in a retention check.
Really? George Washington Carver, that's kind of off the point here, I guess, that you're making, but
I love biographies when I was a kid, and that was one of the first ones I remember reading. It was this fascinating story about this guy who came up with hundreds of different uses, you know, for the peanut there.
And that diligence, as you're pointing out, you know, pays off in life. It is rich in many different ways, but at least, you know, is satisfied, provided for. Okay, so here's our list, and we've already looked at 10, 3 through 5, so turn over to chapter 12 now. Let's go through these one by one. Chapter 12 and verse 11, he who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who pursues vain things lacks sense. Literally there, I've got a footnote on verse 11, he lacks heart. Isn't that interesting? Literally, he lacks heart. Now, if we say somebody, you know, does something heartily, what do we mean?
Eagerly,
they are doing it with all their heart. They are doing it with the attitude Rachel was talking about of really, you know, wanting to and trying to do the best job that they can. So literally it is, excuse me, the word of heart right there. But it's so simple in verse 11. Brethren, remember, they weren't living in the sort of society that we are today. They didn't have the computers and electricity and a host of other devices, you know, that have been provided for our convenience. This was an agrarian culture. And so everybody knew life itself depended on tilling the land. But even when you're in that sort of a culture, and your entire existence depends on, you know, getting the fruits of the ground in your storerooms, still people won't do it. You have to give advice, you know, do this, you know, till your land the way an ant would, is what Solomon is trying to get us to appreciate and understand. Okay, so in verse 11, he who pursues, the last part, he who pursues vain things lacks sense. What the verse is saying is, vanity, fantasy, wishing and hoping and dreaming is going to keep you from tilling. So be careful about all that. Do not pursue vain things. And this is one of my pet peeves, and as a preacher, you know I can tell you what my pet peeves are. No more than anybody else. Brother, if I hear another song or another speech or, you know, another advertisement about dreamers and how wonderful they are, I think I'm just going to go, you know, and bang my head against a wall. The Bible has not got very much positive to say about dreamers. Okay? It's a very practical book. And so, yes, pursue your dreams. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. If you're an inventor, you know, an engineer or something, you know, by all means, God gave you the talent. But for an awfully large number of people, I think, who have been raised on all the popular mythology about all you have to do is just a heart, you know, that longs, you know, for these good things, and their heads are in the clouds, and meanwhile, what are they not doing? Tilling the ground. It just goes a little bit to what Rachel was saying a little while ago, you know, just not getting out there and blaming it on everybody else. You know, it's always some other fantastical reason why you can't get the job done and why you have, you know, our family. Solomon's very practical. Put your hand to the plow. So, how many stories have we heard about the guy who went to work for McDonald's, you know, flipping burgers? This is our standard illustration of having, you know, the lowest paying and least fulfilling job there is. And then the guy winds up with a franchise and making several $100,000 a year. Okay? Happens when you apply yourself. So, verse 24 now, skipping later in this chapter, the hand of the diligent will rule, but the slack hand will be put to forced labor. How many times you look up that chain of command, you know, in a given business and everything, you know, and that guy, he had all the advantages, you know, my boss, he was lucky. Well, you know, maybe, you know, every president and owner of a company, what they're looking for is lucky people, right?
know, that's it. They put ads in the paper looking for a lucky guy. That's what they're looking for. Oh, when people reach these positions of responsibility and power and authority, you know, in any given company or endeavor, what is more likely than luck? Ant-like diligence. Really getting in there and doing the job. Doing that job at its most menial labor level, and then at every other level, until you so thoroughly understand the company that ultimately when something goes wrong, who does everybody have to turn to because you know what's going on? Such a person gets promoted. Such a person gets into positions of responsibility. So here we are now in verse, chapter 12, okay, 13, 24. The hand of the diligent will rule. The slack hand is put to forced labor. You wind up giving the orders rather than taking them if you are diligent from the first day on the job and on down. Let's give it a couple of verses to 27. A slothful man does not roast his prey, but the precious possession of a man is diligence. Now, how many times have we already seen Solomon comparing personal character and various individual qualities to great wealth, precious possessions, wisdom more than gold and silver and all precious jewels? Solomon was the wealthiest guy on the planet, apparently, in his time 3,000 years ago, 1000 B.C. But he was a guy who understood what really mattered, and what tended to bring those riches was the person, the character, the qualities that we call virtue, with diligence being chief among them, so that he says, a slothful man does not roast his prey, but the precious possession of a man is diligence. That is truly precious. And you're the kind of a person who is active at all times. Okay, any comment or question on the 3 in chapter 12? Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, devil's advocate question, I guess, but it seems I remember a scripture somewhere that mentions that people that lack vision come to some kind of a bad end.
Well, the Hosea, when people perish for lack of wisdom or knowledge, but there's another passage too that actually speaks of vision, I think, prophecy. But absolutely.
These qualities Solomon experienced in his life. Now, if ever there was a guy that you might accuse of being lucky, you'd be tempted maybe by Solomon. I mean, after all, where did he get his vast wisdom? Why, God just gave it to him, right? Because he asked for it. All right. But what was the point of all of that?
He had the wisdom to ask for wisdom.
See, there you are. He's wise enough to ask for wisdom. And he's righteous enough to care about God's people first before himself. And so his whole attitude is, I know how to go out or come in and look at your people. You know, so give me wisdom. Right? That is a righteous, self-denigrating, loving others before yourself kind of a quality that didn't make him lucky, made him righteous, and thereby rewarded with the wealth and the wisdom in all that followed. Okay, chapter 14, verse 23. In all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. One of the ugliest jokes I think I ever heard, and one of the funniest too. A guy walked up to me one time years and years ago. He says, do you know what? He said, it's just terrible. The Japanese have invented a new tool that is going to put most of America's Department of Transportation out of work. The Japanese have invented a shovel that will stand up by itself.
Oh, you go, oh, that hurts. Okay. But where does that joke come from? Because we're all driving around, and what do we see a lot of the time?
It's people just standing there. You know, and how do you feel about it when you see it?
You know, it's your tax dollars at work, right?
You know,
$60 million project, your tax dollars at work.
Well, what does this say? 14:23, in how much labor is their profit? All of it. Absolutely all of it. Mere talk leads only to poverty. Okay? So,
I've seen statistics, you know, again, I can't remember any of them, but one time I read a fascinating article where somebody had gone and figured out what a coffee pot costs in an office. In the lost time of people standing around drinking coffee. And then they had calculated what a water fountain cost. How it just was unbelievably expensive if you put one of those things in. Because they would then watch, you know, to see how people would, you know, make their run and just add it up. Cigarettes. Those breaks. You know?
It went on and on and on like that. What is the point of verse 23? What do we have to try to remember if we will be Solomonic in our approach to your work tomorrow?
There's profit in what? All your labor. When you're active, when you're busy, when you're working, when you are actually performing the task that you were hired to do, you will profit, as will the company, and ultimately, you know, riches come. Somebody else had a hand up. Here it is.
I was just going to say that you need to work, not talk.
Amen. That's out of the Proverbs. Okay. All right. Chapter 16. 16 and 26. A worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. What is that one saying?
You don't work, you don't eat.
You don't work, you don't eat. Now, see, I don't think it's in the list. I have to look here. No. Turn over to 17:5 just while you're here. He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished. Now, this is not the same category. It's not the topic of diligence or anything like that. But I did put a note down in my verse for this. Because I know how tempted I am to think in terms, or to be tempted at least, to put people down when I see them standing up, you know, holding a shovel. When I see that they're not working. That they're not employed. You know, and it's real easy to just say, you know, well, maybe the church ought to do something about that. Maybe, you know, we ought to do thus and such or another. Look, we've said this, you know, at least a half dozen times already. There are exceptions to the rules in the book of Proverbs. But be awfully careful, because in 26 of chapter 16, the worker's appetite, his hunger is urging him on, so fine. We always think in terms of, and it was quoted or paraphrased a moment ago, if a man won't work, then what? Neither let him eat. Everybody knows. You know, First Thessalonians there. Okay, well, fine. But what does 17 and verse 5 say? He who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who rejoices at calamity will not go unpunished. Okay? Today I saw a sight, and it just was fascinating to me. And at the same time, it could not have lasted more than 2 seconds. Yet it had such an impact on me, I thought about it for some time after, I bring it up here tonight. All I was doing was going eastbound on the Beltline. And I came to the river there, and as I went over the river, I looked off at the water. And on the bank, just across over there, I could see some man down by the river who had his sleeping bag laid out in the rain. That rain was cold today. That rain was on the border of snow and ice. I was talking about that a little while ago. You know, I think Timothy got all the way up to 35 or some such here today. And I looked out there,
And that man was just standing there like this, looking at his sleeping bag, and he wasn't even moving. And I just immediately, sitting in my nice car with a heater roaring, you know, and all of that, I just immediately, I was so into his shoes. The bag is soaking wet, his clothing is soaking wet, he's freezing. And he's down there, by the way, you know, it's just a little forested area out in there, you know, on the bike path that runs along. And so here's this guy just standing there looking like he's about ready to fall over frozen and dead. And what do you think when you see that? Serves him right? Why didn't he get a job? What do you know about that person's circumstances? Absolutely nothing. Why is he there? I do not know. Okay? The brethren, I've met enough people whose parents were murdered, whose children died young from some disease, who are disoriented because life threw something at them that we can't, you know, even imagine. And they wind up just wandering, deranged, you know, in the world. Or they may well have been born that way. Who knows the story? God only knows the story. So when you're tempted to mock at such a person, when you are tempted in verse 5, you know, to reproach the poor, you are reproaching God too. Now we've seen plenty of verses on diligence and plenty of verses about the sluggard, and there's no excuse, you know, for the alcoholism, the drug addiction, all the other stuff, you know, that comes into play. But you better be careful. So I put 17.5 over there by 16.26 just as a warning for me, because I've been weak and wrong in that regard in the past. If there's anything we should have figured out by now, it is that we are not judges. We are on this earth to help. In fact, the Ephesian letter says that you are to work specifically. Why are you supposed to work? So you will have what? To give to those in need. That's why God ordered that you are supposed to be working, so you have to give away. Okay? So it's just really, you know, a difficult tightrope kind of a walk. We're trying to encourage people not to be sluggards. We're trying to encourage people not to be slothful. Some people can't help it, and that's to their discredit and shame, because they made themselves that way. Other people can't help it. And brethren, it is not their fault. In the U.S. of A., how many times, you know, the old, wish I had a quarter, every time somebody said, boy, he's really stupid. That was so stupid. How dumb can you get? We got whole programs on this. World's dumbest criminals. I haven't watched a single edition, but I see it on my TV guide. No, hey. Brethren, what do you know about why they're that dumb? It's maybe because mom was a crack addict. It's maybe because of fetal alcohol syndrome. It's maybe because of a host of things for which they are not culpable in any way, shape, or form. So we who are strong and healthy, with high IQs, and doing well in life, why are we supposed to have jobs? According to Ephesians. So he can help the guy who's down there by the side of the river, freezing to death, and you don't know why. Okay? It's just all too easy to say, oh, well, you know, his problem. He wouldn't be there, you know, if he was like me. Yeah. And maybe you're headed there for reproaching or mocking his maker. So it's a little bit of a detour, you know, on that one. But this is balancing that Solomon provides for us. Our purpose, though, is diligence. And so look at verse 26. A worker's appetite, we're in 16 now, back to 16:26. A worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. This is why I don't just do handouts for anybody. You know, I'm never slowing down traffic and risking rear-ending, you know, trying to give somebody a quarter just because you're panhandling with a sign, you know, that gets to me. I think you ought to explore it more than that. His appetite does work for him. And if you're just going to be there, you know, to be an enabler, that's bad. Don't let that happen.
But be careful about reproaching him too. Okay, you comment or question on 16:26. 18:9. Chapter 18 and verse 9. He also who is slack in his work is brother to him who destroys. We already had it, worked with the sluggard, but you know it's the antithesis, and so I put it in this list as well, and now you see why I say we have some overlapping right there, but since we did talk about this 2 weeks ago, or several weeks ago, now let's pass on to chapter 24 and verse 27. 24:27. Prepare your work outside and make it ready for yourself in the field. Afterwards, then build your house. Isn't that great how that was just constructed? Look at just the symmetry that went into that simple sentence. Prepare your work outside. So now you have, a vision that Solomon plants in your head. You're outdoors. You have somebody working outdoors. Make it ready for yourself where? In the field. So now you're doing your tilling that we read about in a little while. Then it says, twice, afterwards, and it adds, then build your house. When do you build the house? You build the house when the work is done. Okay? You build the house after you got the work done. Now, which one would you be more,
enjoy it. Raise your hand. I am. How many of you have ever built a house? Okay, I worked for a custom home builder for 4.5 years. I also was a vet, and so back in 1984, we were able to get a loan, and to build a house, and I could do most of the work myself. So we could afford that. We could afford paying anybody else, And I got to tell you, that was exciting. That's fun. Anybody that's been involved in building a house, thinking about that, and working on that, and picking those colors, and doing that floor plan and all that, it's just, it really is. It's just a ton of fun. And so, I would find myself working on the plans. When what? But I should have been doing a lot of other things and would have paid for it. Through the years, I sold ladders, and 14 years I delivered the mail, and I sold dairy feed for a while. I taught driver's ed, and so all the way along these things, you always have those hopes and dreams we were talking about a little while ago, and all that, is fine as long as it does not get in the way of what? The work. What comes first? The work. Being outside in the rain comes first, then you build what? The roof. It's not, I got to build my house so I can go work the field. What is it? Work the field so then you can build a house.
Okay. I remember hearing stories of, when people first came and settled here in the United States, how the wives had itty-bitty houses and they had great big barns.
That's where the livestock goes. That's where the food's going to go. That's where the implements are going to go. Yeah, exactly that. Imagine somebody who built his garage first and then his house. You ever see that? Okay. I'll be smarter. Okay, any other comment or question on that one? Okay, then chapter 27 and verse 18. Not a whole lot of these, as I put it out earlier, and so not too many, but they really need to be added to the list of the sluggard verses too, so that they become a lot of verses on this topic of the opposites of being slack or else being diligent. So in 27 now and verse 18, he who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit, and he who cares for his master will be honored. Now, brother, I'm just real happy we did away with slavery, and the United States, led the way, and it was Bible-believing people that had, the biggest push to make all that happen. And I'm glad for all of that. But nonetheless, slavery in itself is not inherently evil. God certainly had it in place in the Old Testament, and it was certainly in place in Solomon's day, time as well.
And so today, the only, you know, parallel we would have or comparison we would have, it'd be to our employer, and it works just fine. But it would be even intensified if you're thinking about being an actual slave rather than free to quit the job, you know, anytime you like. But 27:18 makes it such a powerful point. He who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit. He who cares for his master will be honored. How many grudging, whining, griping, grousing employees are there in the world today? And who are they working for? Really, nobody. Again, you've all heard the joke about the guy who had thousands of employees, and some guy walked up and said, "Hi, you know, how many people do you have working for you?" And he said, "About half." Yeah. There are people who go to work and they think about my boss, the employer, the company, the business, the country, if they're in politics or some sort of government service. They're actually conscientious and they're thinking about that whole big picture. And then there's the other half. And what are they doing? Well, you know, boss, he didn't understand anything. You know, what does he know? I'm the one that's actually doing the job there, you know, and it's stupid. And on and on and on, you know, and just whining and complaining all the time. Instead of just getting over all of that and applying themselves to do the best job they possibly can for the sake of whom? The master. For the master. Then, what comes? Then comes the honor. See? So often, cart before the horse.
I remember working with several individuals. It seemed like a slogan at the time. They don't pay me enough to do this. And I hated that.
They don't pay you enough to do this, then what should you do?
Get out.
Get out. They're not paying you enough to do it. Get out. Harry, I'm so glad you brought that up, because the one that bothered me is good enough for government work.
Yeah.
You heard that one?
Yeah.
Good enough for government work. That is just the most awful thing that you could possibly say. Talk about bite the hand that feeds you. And an entire nation, a society, you know, that we're a part of, and now your whole attitude is that you want to be slack because this kind of employment is the sort of thing that you just, you know, do slipshod, good enough for that, but you'd really apply yourself somewhere else than be somewhere else. Okay? So I saw another hand written here somewhere, Rachel. Rachel, I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Do you think it could apply just to relationships in general, too? Like, Sarah was supposed to call Abraham Lord, you know, like he was her master.
Yeah, no, I absolutely do. What Rachel is asking there, you know, is could this have a broader application to every aspect of your life? In 27:18, he who tends the fig tree will eat its fruit. Well, if that fig tree is in your backyard, you need those figs, you know, to eat, then fine, it works at that level. If that fig tree is your family, then it works. If that fig tree is your employer, you know, then it works. If that fig tree is your country, your military, you know, it works. And he who cares for his master will be honored. If you respect those interests of whoever it is that is in a position for whatever reason and whatever kind, you know, above you, if you honor them and respect them and you work for them, you know, then it you will reap what you sow. Okay? Sure. I think it worked generally in any other application. Great.
The New King James Version says, "He who waits on his master will be honored." And so I wonder if this is talking about somebody who's employed to be in his master's home and he's waiting on him, you know, bringing him his...
Yeah, and I think so. I view the fig tree as being the illustration. You know, it would work just as well for a grapevine, for instance.
Then we have waiting on his master, whatever function it is. Maybe he's not in the household, you know, as bringing food to the table and that kind of waiting, but he is, you know, out in the field. It's just, they're both illustrations that would call to mind a number of other occupations.
In either case, you're talking about somebody who's directly involved. The guy who's directly involved with taking care of the fig tree, as opposed to somebody who's out there somewhere like in the field or the grain field or something, he's more likely to take care of the fig. And then in the same way, a slave who's in the household, he's probably more likely to be honored by his master.
Yeah, Greg made a good point. I hope everybody hears what he's saying. He made a great point that you will receive back directly from the plant or the individual that you are serving. So you get to eat from the fig tree, you get honor, you know, from the master. And I appreciate the point that you're making. Yeah, you know, there's a direct relationship. Okay,
let's go to another one. We got one more to go. Chapter 28 and verse 19. He who tills his land will have plenty of food, but he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty and plenty. There's that dreamer again, chasing after those empty pursuits, and he has poverty and plenty. Now, let's close with this idea, and looking again at verse 19. He who tills his land will have plenty of food. Now stop. Can there be a famine? Can there be a drought? No. Can your crops fail? Can there be a dust bowl? Did you see that three-part series that was on here not too long ago? Okay. See, those calamities can befall you, and when they do, is there any amount of killing that is just going to make the crop grow?
No.
But what did God guarantee? What does that say? He who tills the land will have plenty of food. While we all know that crops frequently fail. I was talking with some people the other day about the Philippines and how it's just a never-ending story. But Don and I have been sending money to the Philippines now for 35 years, I guess. Okay? In 35 years of supporting the work in the Philippines. Do we ever get to a point where, boy, glad that's over, we finally solved that problem?
No.
No, because where they live, the monsoons are constant, they wipe out the whole crop, they have all kinds of corruption in the government. You know, they got this Islamic problem, especially down in Mindanao, you know, that's going. They got all these things that are against them. So fine. But what did God say about his people?
They'll have enough.
Maybe that they'll be looking to other saints somewhere else in the church, in the community, in the world, you know, to help them. But what is the church all about? See, we're here to have to give to those in need with a congregational responsibility to help those who truly are in need. But if you come to know somebody really well in the church and they're just plain lazy, and you know it, now their poverty comes. We had a half a chapter 1 dealing with it. Then what? Different story, isn't it? Different kind of a story. So I just want us to be aware that this is not promising that, you know, like Jack and his magic bean or something. Go out and go and plant it, and always, you know, you're going to get the crop. God said he would take care of you. It may not come from the crop. It may be what God wants is to drive you off that land because he's got work for you to do somewhere else. So you're going to have to go somewhere else. But he'll care for you one way or another. Mike.
When you're working hard and diligently, you're working for the Lord, and you're doing, and you're not fooling anybody, you're actually really doing it. You're getting more than just your physical food. You're getting your perspective is changing. You're getting. God promised that we were going to get more than we couldn't bear, and you're going to be taken care of.
Amen.
And I've never been in a congregation among any group of saints where you couldn't just ask, you know, tell me a story about how God provided for you on some occasion, you know, where you just never saw it coming. Oh, and everybody has all those stories, you know, to tell. So how many anxieties are there supposed to be in our lives? Absolutely none. No anxiety of any kind. Be anxious for nothing, Paul told the Philippians. So Nick, what's my job? Absolutely conscientious. Diligent as I can be. Every bit of labor has profit. Even if just for the flesh, which is a little, you know. But it, do the job as unto God rather than man. You've read that, haven't you? Do your work as if you were employed down here under the sun by God. And you went into God's factory, you punched a time card for God, and then you said, well, good enough for divine work. Okay? Well, it's a few minutes early, but it's time for the break. Okay. Carol?
This
is a good one, wasn't it? If it comes to you, send it to you.
Anybody else? Sir.
Solomon's father, David, wrote in Psalms 37 and verse 25, I have been old, I have been young, and now am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread.
We're the bad, Jerry. Psalm 37:25, everybody, I have been young and now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread. Psalm 37:25 needs to go right there with 28:19, doesn't it? Thank you, Jerry. Okay, Carol, keep you. Amen. She's made a great point. I think you're all able to hear it there. You know, you're being diligent, not just in the labor, but you are being diligent spiritually, and you're being diligent mentally as well. You're taking everything into account. Okay? Let's close there. And Dick, can I call on you to lead us in prayer?